And now, broadcasting live on Star Worldwide Networks, it's time for Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. If you suffer from addiction to opiate pain relievers, heroin, alcohol, or other substances, we're here to give you hope and help you overcome your addiction. Now, here's your host, Dr. Nelson.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dr. William Nelson, and welcome to another episode of Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery. And this morning, my producer, Robin Cote, and I are going to have a conversation. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning. How are you, Doc?
I'm doing much better. Last week, we were stuck, and I was not feeling well. And I was in a position where I probably would have done just about anything to get out of pain, but knowing the challenges with opiates, Percocet, Oxy, all those, I found other things that I could do to get myself out of a migraine, and I had for 2 or 3 days. So I don't often have those, but man, oh man, it makes you just, pain is such a subjective thing, and I, for one, don't deal with it well. So I was just, you know, antsy and nervous, and I couldn't find a comfortable position. My mind was so preoccupied with how am I going to get rid of this pain. That's why we have such a problem with the opiate and particularly the prescription pain drugs is when people are in that situation, they just, you know, I felt helpless. And actually, that's why we didn't do the show, because I would have been pretty much worthless. But it's good to be back amongst
the living.
Those that don't have that situation. But for those that do, it's if you've never been in that type of pain, you can't judge other people for making the choices that they make.
No, you don't. And that's the hard part, because I have so many friends that have issues with migraines, and I've had horrible headaches and migraines at times. But I mean, how do you deal with that? And some people I know even go as far as doing the Botox thing into the face to mm-hmm. deal with it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's kind of scary. I don't like needles in my face, much less something that could freeze my face permanently.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually have done that with a number of patients. I haven't done it recently, but for a while I had 3 or 4 people that would get a Botox injection probably once every 3 months or so.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, really, it's the area that you would do the injections – for most of the people that I saw were not really in the face. They were more out on the temples and in the muscles behind, right, the base of the skull. And the idea behind it is that Botox is a muscle relaxer, so it stops the nerve impulse that tells the muscle to go into contraction. And people that suffer from migraines, oftentimes their muscle spasms go awry and just create this whole cycle, and they just can't get out of it. And the Botox injection will stop that impulse and the nerve impulse to the muscle, allowing the muscle finally to relax. And it's interesting, if you use too much, a person for a day or two will have a real difficulty to keep their head up. You know, because there's some pretty big muscles, and if you do too much, you get not only do you get the spasm to go away, but also it loses their ability to kind of maintain their posture and their head on the top of their shoulders. So, but for some, it's one of the few things that works.
Wow. And yeah. it's a better alternative than going to the opiates, would think.
Yeah, sure. And that's actually not what I did, but my approach was the same sort of thing, is that my, neck, I have on the right side of my neck, about three vertebrae down on C4, four vertebrae down from the skull. C4, there's 7 cervical vertebrae. The top one next to the skull is C1, the bottom one, just the last one above the ribs is C7. So about halfway down on C4, I have a chronic injury that I played football in high school, and I was the littlest kid on the team. The coach used to tease me, and he goes, William, the cheerleaders are bigger than you.
Oh.
But it didn't stop me from playing, and it didn't stop me from aspiring to be a professional football player, which I dreamed and thought I would actually grow and become, I was just so committed that I was going to play for Michigan State and get drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers, but never happened.
Well, the little guys are scrappers, though. They work perfect in like hockey and stuff because they can get down below the big guys and scrap up in the corner just like a football player could.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. And unfortunately, when the law of physics don't really work that way, the force equals mass times acceleration. And if you weigh, you know, half to, you know, two-thirds of the competition, the physics isn't on your side.
No, you go over like a potato sack,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and you get thrown, like you're running into a brick wall. But yeah, I had five concussions in 1 year. And
whoa.
Quite often lost my ability to remember simple things. I would remember my first name, not my last. I couldn't remember my phone number, couldn't open my locker with the combination. I don't know why, but I still remember after a football game, there was some mix-up, and my parents didn't come to pick me up. And the coach was like, I need to give you a ride. Where do you live? And I go, what's your address? I was like, I couldn't tell him. I could tell him where to go and which street to turn on, but I couldn't give him my physical address. So after that, I kind of figured out that, you know, probably a pro football career and a big signing bonus and $1 million of pay wasn't in my future, and so I had to figure out something else. So then I took up golf.
Yeah, that's like a laid-back, easy sport, right?
Much safer. And then over time, I had another fall. I was rock climbing and fell. And I think the combination of the two put me into this chronic condition that it doesn't happen often, but it happens once, maybe twice a year, where I will get this migraine that arises from this fourth vertebra, and I can pick exactly the spot. I can put my finger on it, and if I press on this, it causes a referral pain. Oftentimes with migraines, a referral, the originator of the pain is in the spine on the fourth vertebra on the right side, but it refers all the way up my side of my face, and it goes over to the top of my head. And it even goes right behind my right eye, and that's the nerve distribution of the nerve that's supplied from that particular vertebra. And long story to describe that, but basically, if I were to just take a pain med, it may help. It probably would help with the pain, but it certainly wouldn't do anything to deal with the actual cause.
Sure.
And so, you know, as a naturopathic doctor, you know, we get this beat into our head, you know, figuratively, obviously not literally, like I just described. But and the idea is you treat the cause. So rather than giving a pain med that would give some short-term relief, it wouldn't do anything to necessarily treat the cause of the pain. And so then I would have easily, with that situation, I would easily be subject to continued pain medication, and then after a while the amount that I was using wouldn't necessarily take care of the pain, and so I would be, you know, very susceptible to those same issues that I treat all the time with people that start out on pain meds, and then because of as you become accustomed to the amount, you need more, and then it becomes less effective. So I'm quite, you know, fortunate and very grateful that I know how to deal with that in that manner.
Well, speaking of that, how do you deal with it for yourself?
Well, I do something. It's called prolotherapy. And prolotherapy is also, you probably wouldn't be a big fan because it also uses needles.
I'm okay with needles for the most part.
Yeah. And but the idea of prolotherapy is a type of physical medicine that's been started way back in the 20s and 30s. And most people have never heard of it. And there's a number of reasons why. But one of the reasons, I think, is no doctor learns this in medical school. So there isn't a course in prolotherapy when you get your MD, DO, or in my case, a naturopathic medical degree. I guess now at the Southwest University for Naturopathic Medicine down in Tempe, they do offer a side track where you can learn how to do this therapy. And so the idea behind it and the reason why it's called prolotherapy is prolo, the first part of that stands for proliferative. And what is the idea of proliferative therapy is we're using an agent that you put into the body through injection that is a proliferative causing inflammation. And so, you know, being an astute person, the logical question would be, why in the world would you want to cause inflammation in something that's already painful? And the reason for that is when you have a soft tissue injury, and this is what we're talking about, ligaments and tendons. And ligaments are those rubber bands, kind of tough, resilient, and flexible, amazing tissue in our body. And a ligament holds the bones together. So it holds the bones in place. And the idea and what occurs is through what happened with me, injury, auto accident, for women, childbirth, you stretch out these ligaments. And if you can imagine a ligament being a rubber band, and in the Arizona sun in the middle of the summer when it's 115 degrees and 10% humidity, if you left a brand new rubber band outside in Arizona, probably within a month, if you went out there and every day stretched it, probably within a month it would become so hard, dehydrated and brittle that probably within a month if you stretched it, it would just break.
Right, and that's when you go to do something with it, it snaps back at you.
Yeah.
Right.
And the same sort of thing happens with these ligaments that hold the bones together. And when we're young, like my little grandson, he's going to turn 3 in May.
Aww.
And that little guy is like literally like a rubber band. He can sit there and, you know, his mother is really funny. She was showing us that she's doing, I forgot what they call it, a squat challenge where you take a before and after where you, I guess you get in, you know, your Lululemon pants and then take a picture of your butt. And then you do 100 squats a day for 30 days. And then people are doing before and afters on this. And I guess this is a new thing. But it was funny, as she was describing this to us, our little buddy, the little 3-year-old, he also did a squat. But with older people, myself in particular, my joints are not as flexible as his. And if I do a squat and if I can get my thighs to the point where they're, you know, parallel to the ground, that's a pretty low squat. Maybe it's slightly below that, but he could just get there and he could squat. And he's like, I do squats too. And he got down. And so his little butt was touching his heels and his foot was flat on the ground.
Wow.
So little people and young people, before they have the insult of modern living and nutrition and all of the stressors and all the things that happen to us as humans as we age, their little rubber bands are strong and flexible, and it's like that rubber band just being pulled out of the package. And those of us who have had the good fortune to spend some time on this planet, and each time we take the trip around the sun, and I've done 55 of these things, each time our body starts to age a little bit.
Right.
And where I probably at that age could do the same thing, you know, by the time you're 18 and 20, you're starting to, after you go exercise, you might be a little sore. And then by 30, if you go out and overdo it, you're like, oh man, I'm so sore. By 40, if you overdo it, you might be laid up for a couple of days. And now if you're, you know, in your 50s and 60s, a lot of people are fortunate that if they can even exercise and hike or do some of these things.
I can do the squat. It's the getting back up afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea is that when we're younger and if we've taken really good care of ourselves and there's less aging, and the aging that happens in the brain and the muscles, but in these ligaments become more or less flexible, weakened, and more subject to injury. And so this long story that I'm describing, hopefully it's helpful to understand, is that we can, through this proliferative therapy, through the injection of a very precise placement of the needle, we can inject a proliferative non-steroidal right into this area where the ligament attaches to the bone.
Wow.
And by the proper placement, we can initiate an inflammatory response. And this goes back to the earlier question, why in the world would you want to introduce inflammation into something that's already painful? The idea is with soft tissue, ligaments that connect bone to bone, but also tendons that attach the muscle to the bone, right where that tendon or ligament, right where that attaches into the bone, it's called the enthesis, and it is the most highly innervated tissue in regards to muscular and skeletal pain. And so through the very precise placement of the needle right where that tendon or the ligament attaches to the bone, if you can place the needle there and then inject something that causes inflammation, it gives the body a second chance to heal.
Okay.
And with soft tissue injuries, you have about a 6 to 8 week window for the body to regenerate, repair, and restore function to these ligaments. But if you hear someone, athletes will oftentimes have, we call it a torn ACL, so that's in the knee. Or baseball pitchers will have a torn ligament in the elbow, and they will get the Tommy John surgery. Oftentimes, people will get what they call a torn rotator cuff in the shoulder. These are all injuries that are soft tissue injuries, and they have to do with this this tearing or weakening of these very important rubber bands in our body. And if you don't get proper movement back, and with proper nutrition and rehabilitation and getting circulation and new tissue into these injuries, you have about a 6 to 8 week window in which the body can repair. And if that doesn't happen, most people are just going to have chronic pain in these areas, and they might be slightly helped with physical therapy. Massage might help, detissue massage. Acupuncture might help. Chiropractic adjustments might help. But the sign that you have this problem is that any of these things, you may get temporary relief, but you need to do it. You know, some people will get a massage a week, and if that's what it takes to keep you out of pain, it's definitely worth it. And well, I don't want to downplay these things.
And that's a bonus too, because think about that, the human touch. We all crave the human touch, and a massage is actually taking better care of ourselves, working the toxins out of the system, not just helping the other problems that you have as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a great time to relax and enjoy yourself for a while.
Yeah, no, there's no question that massage is one of the best things on the planet, because, you know, and sometimes people will go in and they'll want to get this deep tissue massage where they're really going in there really hard and it hurts. It's mm-hmm. one of the, it's right on that point. You're like, oh, I don't know if it hurts or it feels good, but it's right there is usually where you get some real good lasting benefit, improving range of motion and decreasing some of the pain. But obviously the human touch and being able to, the endorphin release and the relaxation and the connection is so beneficial for all other aspects, some kinds of help with sleep, depression, you know, all those sorts of things, and feeling like you're being taken care of. Oftentimes when we're through our course of our day, through our job, our families, and all of our commitments, we don't really take care of ourselves.
True.
So in that regard, it's so beneficial. Where I think the prolotherapy comes in is that for those that get benefit from that, but they don't ever seem to improve, they kind of stay static as far as their pain levels and their improved function, improved range of motion, and if they've lost the ability to do certain activities, they never really move forward. They don't get worse, but they don't get better. And so those types of people are good candidates for prolotherapy. And I should mention in that same thing, although it's not as comfortable as massage, is acupuncture sometimes can help in this way, chiropractic adjustments, and physical therapy sometimes is really important post-surgery or post-injury, but oftentimes they kind of it only improves things for a while. And then once you've kind of hit that plateau, then usually you're not going to get much function back. And so with the dominant medical paradigm, if you're in that situation, where do people go next? And in often cases, they're going to go to their primary care doctor, And they're going to say, okay, well, let's put you on some Vicodin, Percocet, oxycodone, hydromorphine, all of those things that we're trying to avoid.
Right.
Or if they know that people aren't going to want to do that, they'll try to provide anti-inflammatories, say Advil, Tylenol. And sometimes we talked earlier on a show where you can alternate the two, and sometimes that's helpful and beneficial. But if those methods don't work, then the next option for those people is oftentimes surgery. And even though there are cases where surgeries have really changed people's lives, I know some people that have had knee replacements where they're unable to walk, and then after the knee replacement, they're out walking, playing golf. Those are some miracles that are happening. I think we're getting really good in the medical field with knee replacement and also hips. But the spinal fusion or the laminectomies that are happening in the back, and the shoulder surgery, I guess with the torn rotator, those are sometimes helpful and beneficial. And that Tommy John surgery that the famous baseball player, he's named after him, that can be really helpful. But for so many others, they'll have this pain, lack of function, lack of mobility. It's affecting their activities of daily life. And so they'll get to the point where they will do a knee replacement, hip replacement, spinal fusion, laminectomy, where those terms are laminectomy. Obviously, you're taking the disc out, or sometimes they're doing a fusion where the spots in the spine come together, and they'll fuse that.
Right.
And that may give some stability to improve things. But then within 5 years, you're probably going to have to do the next level up or the next level down, because it doesn't get rid of the problem.
Right.
So in all of those cases, a much more conservative, and in my case, for what's happened to me in my neck, is, you know, a life-changing treatment, and that's this prolotherapy. So a much more conservative, much less potential for harm, little or no chance for harm, and has been really, really effective for all sorts of these injuries. And so what started this conversation way back 10, 15 minutes ago when you asked me, how did I get rid of my migraine? Stephanie, my wife, doesn't really like it when I do this, but I was in such a sad state that I didn't have time to call a doctor or find someone to do it. So I did my own injection into the fourth vertebra of my spine.
Wow.
looking in the mirror. And I've done it so many times that I can do it pretty effectively. And I wouldn't, obviously, this is one of those things, don't try this at home for those of you listening. Because there are things and structures in there that if you were to make a faulty move and put it in the wrong place, you could pierce the, go into the spinal cord, which is not a good idea. Or there's a vertebral artery that you could also puncture. So I know, luckily, I'm a good student of anatomy. I know where those things are. And she actually came into the bathroom and she's, I can't watch you do that.
Yeah, it's like, honey, turn around. Don't watch.
I said, don't watch. Don't. And then when I finally got that needle in the right spot, I kind of jumped. And that's when I know it's in the right spot. And then just this small amount of very safe, non-toxic and natural substance, it goes right into that spot, and there's also a little bit of local anesthesia. So initially, it's numbed, so my pain went away within 2 or 3 minutes, and then that proliferative action happens. And so, even though I initially got rid of the migraine, I know that that's just temporary with the anesthesia, the local anesthesia, and then over the next 24 hours, there's an increase in pain. But the pain is different because now it's inflammation right in that area where the body needs to heal. And so the reason for the injection is there's all different sorts of substance that can be used. But what I use oftentimes is just some local anesthesia and then what I call an osmotic product. And it sounds ridiculous, but it's dextrose. And dextrose, since it has a different chemical structure, it causes the cells right next to the injection to burst. And so a few of the cells will burst, any of the other, and in that destruction of the cells, it releases chemical mediators and starts an inflammatory process. And the reason we want to do that is now the body is kind of given a second chance to heal. And so what will happen is through the inflammation, the arachidonic acid, and some of these leukotrienes, and these are terms for chemical substances that cause heat and cause some pain and cause swelling and redness. And those are the signs of inflammation. And so the question comes back to, why in the world would you want to do that? Because then the body is reawakened, or it needs to acknowledge that, oh, it's like it's a new injury. And so when that happens, all of that chemical, the miracle of how our body works and the healing process, is now that chemical message is sent out. And then so my body, if you are in relatively good health, will initiate a healing response. And so we hear about stem cells.
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, so my body has stem cells that are undifferentiated. Oftentimes they're in the fat of the body. And so this miraculous event happens where you cause an inflammation, this chemical message is sent out like a siren, and so the body says, oh, there's an injury there. And so it sequesters stem cells, it sequesters macrophage, which will eat up the scar tissue and the old rubber band. And then over the next week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks, my body will continue to try to rebuild that ligament and tendon in order to, you know, replace the old worn-out rubber band.
And that's what they're working on, too. Now, I know that some of the other countries around the world are doing stem cell therapies. There was one of the guests on a show the other day who was talking about his clinic actually starting to do that, but it's not regulated, I guess, in America to do the stem cell injections. But I think it's a great thing because our body has a way of regenerating. Our body has a way of healing ourselves. I saw it firsthand in 2001 when my husband was sick with cancer and eventually died. But, I mean, he came close to death several times, and I saw things that really amazed me about the human body. I couldn't believe how much stuff he had gone through after chemotherapy and how the body extruded some of the stuff that was in him and how wonderful and miraculous we really are inside out.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good example of in another area where I worked in a cancer clinic, an alternative cancer clinic, for almost 3 years. And so many of the patients that I saw were people that already had done the traditional route. They had their initial diagnosis, maybe had a surgery to remove the primary tumor, looked as though that their body had healed and they recovered from cancer. And then 6 months to a year later, the cancer recurred in another area, whether it be in the lymph nodes, along the bone, or what have you. And the interesting thing is the surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, which are the three modalities used in conventional medicine cancer treatments, those things have been around for 100 years. And there hasn't really been any major, massive improvement with the outcomes and the effectiveness, and certainly the subjective side effects that a person suffers when they do these treatments.
Right.
So there hasn't been any major improvements in this area of treatment for hundreds of years, even, you know, in the 100 years since they discovered, you know, chemotherapy and radiation. And even though we put millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars into research, they're only just a new drug trying to accomplish the same thing. And so how this is germane to what we're discussing is that in the work that I did in the cancer clinic, some of the people would come in with a diagnosis of, you know, they've been through their chemotherapy and the radiation and the cancer spread all over, and they were given, you know, go get your life in order. There's nothing really you can do other than palliative care to help with the pain. And so their quality of life is going to be pretty horrid, and they were given, you know, 3 months to live. And some of those people I treated for a year, 2 years, And a small percentage of them actually went into remission where they no longer had diagnosable cancer. I didn't say they were cured, because anytime a person is cured of something like that, quote unquote cured, then oftentimes they go back to the lifestyle that brought them into that situation.
Right.
And so the way in which our treatments worked is that it goes back to what we're talking about, is the body has so much more ability to heal and to regenerate and to like have miraculous recoveries, whether it be cancer or these horrible, horrible injuries where the dominant medical paradigm and the specialists that are wonderfully gifted and educated in this area of treatments, they tell them the only thing that you can do is chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery. And then in the case of these auto accidents or these things, it's like, you know, we'll do the conservative thing. We'll get you some physical
therapy. We'll give you
therapy.
A pill.
We'll give you physical therapy. We'll give you pain meds. And if that doesn't work, we're going to cut out the piece. We're going to treat you like an automobile and replace your carburetor or your fuel injector, or, you know, in the case of the knee and the hip primarily, where they're doing knee and hip replacements. But doing something natural where you kind of look at the, in both cancer and in these chronic pain and these chronic injuries, first you clean up the body. And so the body wants to heal. The body has a miraculous ability to heal. But there's so many things we do in life, in our lifestyle, in our foods that we choose to eat, in the relationship stress, job stress, the type A behavior that's demonstrated every day on Scottsdale Road. If you don't run a red light and the person behind you is giving you the finger going, run the red light, you idiot. You know, I've noticed, it's interesting.
Tell us how you really feel, Doc.
Yeah, I'll see people with, you know, they want to be spiritual. They want to have this like evolved perspective. And on the back of their bumper, it says, imagine world peace. And then as you watch that person in their driving behavior, and if someone, you know, does something on their drive, they're yelling at them and flipping them off. I'm like, well, world peace could start in your driver's seat when giving other people, like treating them like they're not your worst enemy, just because it's going to stop you. Or it's going to slow you down 5 seconds before you pull into your house and your driveway and watch, you know, TV. So anyway, I'm getting on a soapbox now. But
No, because think about it, though. It's a mindset.
Yeah.
It's a mindset all the way around. And because if you're around negative people or toxic people, you tend to take on their moods.
Yeah.
It's a domino effect. Every day I drive just like everyone else does. I have a Mustang, so I like to drive a little faster.
Nice.
Or at least the speed.
So you're
limit.
The person that cut me off.
No. I don't do that because that's bad karma. That can come back to haunt me. So I try to be the best driver possible. If someone ticks me off, I just blare my music, say a few cuss words under my breath, and just deal with it and blow it out because I don't hold it in. But I'm not going to stick my hand out the window, because if that person's having a lousy day, or even worse, they could have a gun under their seat, and just because I chose to yell at them, they might take it out on me in a different way. So you have to think about all the elements and how you affect things. And I, as you know, we run into a lot of people here in the studio, and a lot of times people come in here with sometimes kind of having a bad day. They don't need me to add to that. The first thing I'm going to do is try to make them smile or laugh, or to get them in a better mood, as I did with you when you came in. We gave each other a hug, and that's how you start the process of human kindness. You just have to be able to put yourself in that mindset, and it really does affect everything about your life.
Yeah, and I think that point is not only germane to what we're describing, is how you get your body in a position to heal is really what we're talking about, whether it be cancer, acute or chronic injury, or injury that hasn't healed, or in the case of the title of the show, addiction, is what is your environment? And, you know, we live in an environment right now that I'm going to sound like my grandfather, in the 55 years that I've been on this planet, I think that we have lost so much of what used to be expected of people.
Yeah, you're right.
And what I'm discussing is your very point, is how to be considerate, You know, I think it's almost at a point now in our political environment is the ability to insult someone and to demoralize them and to rip them apart and to find their worst possible characteristic and exploit that. And we do things, and those are looked at as strengths. Oh, you're strong because you can demoralize someone because of something that they suffer from or something that someone's going through.
Oh, God, no, that makes them the weakest of all.
I know, but it's like you look at our politics and, you know, I don't think we've lost the ability in our culture to understand that we have so many things more in common than that which separates us. And if we're constantly only dealing with and interacting with the people that share ideas and our beliefs, now we're becoming more and more polarized.
Yeah.
And so whether it be in medicine or whether it be in politics, whether it's conservative against liberal, Democrat versus Republican, and it enters into race, religion, country of origin, sex for male and female, with all of the Me Too and all these, and it's becoming, we are becoming a society that is becoming more and more polarized, more and more isolated, and we vilify someone who isn't in our tribe.
True. A lot of people do.
And, you know, our tribe can be our family or people that are in our social economic class, people that are in our same level of education, people that are from our same ancestry or country of origin, people that share our common language, whether it be English, Spanish, or what have you. And not only in this country, but in other countries as well, in the global community. So, you know, I didn't really feel like we were going to get into this conversation, but I think it's something that needs to be said. And so what is the solution? How do you protect yourself? How do you live in this world, but don't allow the negativity and the stress and the confrontation and the drama? How do you go through your day-to-day activities and how you operate without negatively affecting your health? And I think the best thing to do is what you've just described. You know, being considerate of others, giving people the benefit of the doubt, and if someone happens to do something that you could possibly take offense to, just say, you know, they must be having a bad day, give them a break. And it almost feels good. I've had this happen a couple of times where my reaction is I'm trying to get someplace and someone does something, I'm like, ah, and I'm almost ready to beat my horn or say something or yell, and I'm just like, okay, that's not going to help me. So I just wave them in, congratulations, go ahead. And then afterwards, I have this kind of sense like, oh, I didn't add to the dysfunction.
Right, and it's all based on actions and reactions. And if you can't predict how another person is going to act, you can only be responsible for your own reactions.
There you go. And there's the tell. That's the best underlying message is in all of our interactions, whether if you're in school or having to do with personal relationships and friendships at school, and kids can be so mean to each other.
Yes.
And especially in adolescence and junior high school and high school. And then when you get out, some people never graduate from that, you know, seventh grade behavior.
That mentality.
And so now they're the mean kids at work. And oftentimes it's because they are lacking in some sort of self-esteem or somehow not feeling good about themselves. And so the way they deal with it is they're catty, sarcastic, or backstabbers to other people. And the interesting thing is, I think it was Wayne Dyer, who is someone that I used to listen a lot to. He does self-help and kind of a more like a new agey type personal development. And I still remember one of the comments that he said, and I still think about this, and I talked with my children about this, is he said he was, you know, at home and trying to write his book or something, and one of his kids came in and they're really upset, and he's like, what happened? It's like, oh, you know, so-and-so at school, they said this about me, and they said this about me, and they said this about me, and the kid was just next to tears and just so angry and so frustrated and humiliated and just experiencing all these emotions. And even though the child might have been 7 or 8 years old, those emotions were real. And for an adult, they're like, oh, that's just okay, you know, get over it. But for the kid, that's like massive, huge problem. And
it's traumatizing.
I still remember his response. And he goes, all right, I have a question for you. They said all these things about you. What do you think about yourself? And they said, well, I'm not any of those things. I'm smart and I'm nice. And I, you know, all these things, and almost the exact opposite of what they were being ridiculed or teased about. And he says, okay, and that you're the interesting thing that you have control over how you respond. And if you know those things to be true about yourself, you are never going to be able to control everybody else's opinion about you.
Right.
And you're never going to be able to control those that say and do things that are mean-spirited, sarcastic. Sometimes they don't even realize they're doing it. Sometimes they do it purposely. But you're never going to be able to control everybody else's behavior. The only one that you can control is your own, and you can control your own response. So if you have this strong sense of self, you feel good about yourself, and you surround yourself with people that are of like mind, mm-hmm. that's going to grow, and you're going to be in this little bubble of people that get along.
And I had this happen last night, as a matter of fact. One of my friends who is 67, right, went through a divorce in the process of selling the house, and I didn't hear from him for a couple of days, which I'm used to hearing from him every day. And he calls me last night, and the sound of his voice, I swear to God, it just was not the vibrant personality. And I'm like, what's going on with you? Oh, my ex-wife this, my ex-wife that. She's talking down to me. She's telling me I'm a piece of crap, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, dude, you're not married to her right now. You're in the process of selling the house. Well, it's going to close in 3 weeks, and she's doing all this because she's got a vent and she's taking it out on me. I said, okay. I said, first of all, stop it. Go look in that mirror. What kind of a person are you? Why are you letting her tell you these things? You know you're not that person she's saying. She's projecting stuff onto you because she's not happy with her own life. She made the choice. You guys ended the marriage. You're selling the house. She needs to get over it. And you need to stop letting her take this out on you and letting it affect you. So even at 67 years of age, he's being bullied by an adult.
Yeah.
And we don't realize what that does to our self-esteem. And I empower as many people as I can, because I myself have been in relationships that have taken my self-esteem right down the toilet. And I didn't honor my self-worth. But I've come to the realization at 50 that I can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
It all relies on us. We cannot find our self-worth through other people. And that's the biggest thing, is you've got to have that ability to give yourself that pep talk every day. I don't care how bad your day's going. Get in that mirror, look at your face, tell yourself you're beautiful, tell yourself you're awesome. Put that stuff right back into who you are, and yeah. not let the other people get to you.
Yeah, I think a couple take-home messages is, you know, you can't control the other person's reaction or their opinion of you. Or the only way you can control your access or your influence by those people is to withdraw from the thing. Is like, and you could set the boundaries. You know, in his instance, he could say, listen, I know you're going through a lot. We're both going through a lot. This is really emotional. But here's how I'm going to go from here on out.
Right.
Not just to withdraw without saying, but there's something empowering to say, with all due respect, I want this relationship to be productive. I want it to be supportive. And even though it's very difficult, we can do it a couple different ways. But in the future, if I find our conversation is one where it's negative and either one of us are saying things that are mean-spirited and finding fault with the other person, laying blame with the other person, making accusations or character assassinations or really mean things, I think that we should both agree that we both have the right to say, listen, this conversation right now is not productive, and I'm going to hang up now. Or if we're together, I'm going to leave, and give us time to blow some steam off or do something else, talk to one of our friends. And if in the future we can have a conversation that is supportive, productive, and in a way that's uplifting, those are the conversations that I'm committed to. But just so you know, if we get in that situation, I'm just going to say, not make a boundary. And as long as it's been established, then it's not rude. So, and I think for adults, you can do that. For kids, it's probably a little easier just to say, just go play with other kids.
Right.
But so it's fascinating because that same dynamic that happens in like little kids in grade school and nursery school and all these things, you know, and the main thing is, you know, they're saying mean things. And what do you feel about yourself? Well, I think I'm great. Okay, then that's what's important. That's what you have to hold on to. And who cares about what other people think about you? You know, the challenge is if you give that person power, and it's usually you give power to someone you care about. So those most cutting and harmful conversations are the people you really love. And maybe in the course of their lifetime, in the course of their relationship, ebbs and flows, they still have a deep feeling and caring for that person, and they want them to respect them. They want them to love them. But the person that when you love and want the respect, when they're giving you all the crazy, you know, the crazy yeah. behavior because they're struggling emotionally, that's when that boundary can be really effective. But I love what you said. And then the secret is find things that you love to do. Find people that are uplifting. Find people that are looking for ways to make things better, way to support each other, and looking for people to affirm those positive things about you. And if you are wondering where you're going to be and how your life is going to be, just look at your closest circle of friends.
Right.
And in 5 years, those. You're going to be most like those people that you surround yourself with.
And I wrote about this morning, actually, on my author page. If you want to attract quality people, a quality relationship, then you've got to step up to the plate and be a quality person yourself.
Yeah, because who wants, imagine if you're the downer.
Exactly. No one wants to be around you.
No one wants to be around them. They'll go, oh, no. Here comes Robin. She's complaining again. You know, I'm not to say that you can
vent.
Share your yeah. feelings like, man, this is really frustrating. But if you're open to having someone listen and maybe give you some guidance or just listening and someone that really cares, as long as you're not doing it all the time and as long as you're not downplaying them and
stay stuck
monopolizing the conversation. Every time you get together, you're complaining about the
right.
stuff and talking about the same thing. Yeah, those conversations and those relationships can really be so one-sided.
Oh, yeah. I've had a few friends like that. And one of the ladies who was my best friend for a while, I've kind of distanced myself from her because it's always negative. And it's like I try to be the best friend possible I'm known as the brick wall. So I tell everybody, look, if you don't want it sugar-coated, this is who I am. But if they're not willing to do the work to change their life, then please don't continue crying to me month after month, year after year, that your life's not changing. There's we can change. We've all been through traumatic times. We've all been through hardships, but it's what you do with the rest of your life that defines you, not the mistakes, not the tragedies. Pick yourself up, dust yourself off.
Yeah. So I'm gonna make an attempt to bring this back to what we were originally talking about. And how does this play into the process of recovery? And so I think the take-home message is that people who are not suffering from addiction or in addiction recovery, they have a ton of challenges. They have life's events that present themselves, and they have day-to-day they're able to make choices. How am I going to respond to this challenge? How am I going to respond to this thing that is seemingly insurmountable? You know, lose a job, have a bankruptcy, have a divorce, have the loss of a loved one, have a severe illness, loss of a parent, you know, some of these things, or God forbid, I don't even want to say it, but loss of a child, which happens in this area of addiction that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
What is the difference between those who are in addiction and those who those that do not have a problem with addiction and those who have an addiction or an addiction recovery, The difference is they both have the same challenges, but the person in addiction and addiction recovery, they probably have not developed the skill set, the lifestyle choices, and the ability to figure out how to get through those really hard times without the use of a mind-altering substance.
Right.
And so that, you know, if you boil it all down, people in addiction and addiction work, we talk about as soon as a person starts to use, whether it be alcohol, marijuana, heroin, or what have you, their emotional development pretty much stays right there. And I've had kids in my office that their first use of heroin was when they were 11 years old.
Oh, my God.
So if you can only imagine a 25-year-old or a 35-year-old that comes in and they look like they're 30, their vocabulary would indicate that they're 30 years old, and for all practical purposes, you would assume that person has the maturity level of a 30-year-old. But because of what I just mentioned, their emotional maturity, their ability to cope with life stressors and life events, they're basically 11-year-old, which is a fifth grader or a sixth grader.
Wow.
And so those are the things that need to be addressed once the physiological and the biochemical addiction has been dealt with. So in the case of what I do, for those of you first time listening, we in our office, we do a naltrexone pellet insert. A naltrexone pellet is something that blocks the effects of opiates and heroin and the prescription pain meds, makes it impossible for a person to get high, and takes away the craving. So that's the physiological biochemical approach, but it does nothing to do with what we just described.
Right.
And so those people that have the best success with long-term sobriety, which is what we're all after, is during the time they have this protection medication that will prevent them from relapsing back into drug use. If they take that time and energy previously used to avoid using, and now they're working on themselves, they're developing a group of support like what we talked about, where that those people may be in recovery, or it may be people that are just really positive. They're also learning coping mechanisms. What do you do when you get really frustrated? What do you do when you get disappointed? What do you do when life knocks you on your ass? Are you going to get up, or are you going to go back to numbing yourself so you don't have to feel it? And it sounds really preachy, but those of us who aren't addicted, that's what we do. And we find things that we love to do.
We become addicted to other things.
We find things that we love to do. I love to play disc golf. I love to rock climb. Last night, Stephanie, my wife, and I, we had our first dance lesson.
Aww.
And I got her dance lessons for Christmas because I love my wife dearly. But oftentimes we're so tired during the week that we want to go out and work out, and we kind of like, let's go to the gym. I don't like going to the gym. She does. She go to Zumba. But we may want to go hiking. But I bought her some individual lessons with a dance instructor. It was so fun.
That's cool.
Because I feel like such a dork when we go out somewhere and some music comes up and I'm like, let's dance. And then I'm like, I'm so awkward. I don't know which foot goes where. I'm going to put my hand, how to do anything.
Oh, you're so cute.
And we had the best time. It was great. Imperial Ballroom in Scottsdale. Rose, thank you if you're listening. And it was so awesome because she said, let's just start with something basic. Learned a basic step. And she even taught us, like, how, when you ask her to go out to the dance floor, how do you escort her out there? You don't pull her, and she doesn't pull you. You just kind of go, and she like coached us. It was so much fun. It was a riot.
That's so cool.
So anyway, the point being, we find things that we get excited about. We find ways to enjoy life. We find things to maybe help change our mood if we decide we're going south.
Right.
And then, you know, also find ways to see if you can, whether you be there for somebody else or find a way to make a contribution,
yes,
either in your job or with a charity, or if you start focusing on other people, then it's harder to worry about your challenges because no matter how bad things are, there's somebody else that's in a worse state.
You got that right.
So with the apologies for sounding so preachy, I've had a good time, Robin, and this was a great conversation.
Doc.
And for those of you out there, my name is Dr. William Nelson. Thank you for listening to another episode of Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery. Another episode that covers some of these same things from a different perspective, we recorded on February 14th, and it has to do more with the basics of diet, supplement, and those sorts of things. So that these two things combined hopefully will help. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. Listen live each week at this time or anytime 24/7 on demand at StarWorldWideNetworks.com.